everyone. Today is the first official day of a new administration in the United States, an administration that has promised reexamination of trade relationships, reconsideration of our relationships on a political basis with other countries, whether those countries be China or Mexico, an administration that has promised deregulation in key sectors of our society, and one that has raised unique challenges, particularly regarding the business of the president. With the new administration comes new people through appointments, challenges to them when they are subject to Senate confirmation. We have the prospect of a nomination to the United States Supreme Court, and the list goes on. We thought it fitting to have this event today, in particular the first Monday after the inaugural, to look objectively at the legal issues that arise from the Trump administration. I would like to thank in advance Associate Dean Phyllis Goldfarb, who suggested the idea of this panel way back in December. And I'm delighted that when we teed up the idea of having a discussion, my colleagues on the faculty indicated a willingness to be here. My introduction of them will be very brief. Some of you, I know them very well through studying under them and the like. We have a lot to cover, and we want to make sure there's plenty of time for questions and discussion. And so we will first hear from Alan Morrison, the Lerner Associate Dean for Public Interest and Public Service Law. As you know, he's an expert on constitutional law, having argued more than 20 cases in the Supreme Court of the United States. After that, we will hear from Professor Emily Hannon, who is an expert on energy law, environmental law, and administrative law. Then we'll hear from Steve Schooner, the National Sabinic Professor of Government Procurement Law and co-director of the George Washington University Law School's Government Procurement Law Program. Professor Schooner has been focused in the last month in particular on issues concerning the Trump Organization's lease with the GSA over the hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue, and has had a number of public conversations about that topic. After hearing from Professor Schooner, we will hear from Professor Donald Clark, David Weaver Research Professor of Law, and he is an expert on the law of China and United States-China legal relationships. As you may recall, one of the first comments that President Trump during his after his election with regard to foreign countries was specifically dealing with China. And then finally, we'll hear from Professor Steve Charnovitz. Professor Charnovitz is an expert in the area of international trade law. Over the last few hours, there have been significant developments in this area in terms of the TPP and NAFTA. Professor Charnovitz brings to the subject a perspective of the Hill as well, because he had worked under two speakers of the House before he came to the George Washington University Law School. And so with that, I will now turn the floor over to Dean Morrison.
Thank you, Susan.
Please come in and have a seat, everyone. Yeah, plenty of seats.
And don't hesitate to use the jury box if you're comfortable over here.
And no one will be called on if they sit in the first row. As some of you may know, there was a lawsuit filed today by an organization called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington against President Trump involving the Emoluments Clause. It's a long lawsuit, and there are many issues, including standing and the merits, and I'm actually not going to talk about those now because I think we'll probably talk about them later, but I wanted to talk about a number of other areas in which lawyers should be keeping an eye on and expect to be important sources of information about what's going on in the Trump administration. So the one area of law as to which we know that you have opportunities to go to court and not have to worry about standing is the Freedom of Information Act. It, of course, applies not to the President of the United States, but it applies to all of his agencies. And since most of what's going to happen is going to happen at the agency level, making FOIA requests on a regular basis and going to court is going to be a very important aspect. Second, I would be shocked if the White House in particular and the rest of the agencies in general did what the federal law requires in terms of keeping records of emails. If you come out of private business, people do not keep email records in the same way that people in government keep them. And so I expect that there's going to be inquiries early on as to whether the White House email system is up and running and the records are being saved, or whether they're being routinely destroyed, which is, I expect, what's going to happen until somebody goes to court and tries to stop that from happening. Second area that I want to talk about is agencies are going to have to cannot simply change their mind and reverse all the rules that have been put into effect. The Supreme Court in 1984, in a case called State Farm, ruled that if you have a rule in effect, it's gone through notice and comment rulemaking and been approved by an agency, it's possible for the agency to change its mind, but it has to have good reasons for doing so and has to go through the same notice and comment rulemaking process. And that's going to take time, and it's going to be subject to challenges in the court if they back off on various other rules. Third is, you may have seen that the president issued an executive order the other day directing all of the agencies to do what they could within the requirements of law, unless otherwise required by law, to undermine the Affordable Care Act. This is hardly a surprise in that he's tried to do this. It actually is, in a way, going to be helpful, because to the extent that agencies are going to try to build records to remove many of the regulations, and by the way, there are probably lots of these rules that they can't do anything about. Among them, I haven't double-checked it, but the individual mandate was required by statute, and the agencies just can't simply decide not to do that or not to enforce that statute. Having had the president tell them what they're supposed to do will undermine, at least in part, any claim justification they have to the extent that they're going to rely on their discretion to do so. Next, the last thing I want to mention is the president is going to try to fire various officials. He has been able to remove most of them, but one of them he's not been able to remove, and he said he's going to remove, is the person who's head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This was an independent agency established by Congress as part of Dodd-Frank, and it's unique in several respects that the person is appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate for 5 years. It is a single person running the agency, and the president can, by statute, only remove the person for cause. Trump has clearly indicated that he's going to try to remove Richard Cordray for cause. He doesn't like what he's doing, and neither do all of Trump's business supporters. And so the question is, when is he going to try to do that, whether he's going to allege cause or not, and if so, is as the D.C. Circuit, a couple of judges' opinions said, that the limitation on the firing for cause is unconstitutional as it forbids the president from firing. For those of you who take constitutional law, we'll get to this issue later in the semester, or it's in administrative law, but it's a very important and timely issue, so look for that to happen. And there are other firings that the president's going to try to do. He certainly is going to try to remove the head of the Legal Services Corporation, who I believe does not have any statutory protection. And, of course, one of the issues is who's going to replace the various people and whether they're going to be able to get them through the Senate or not. So I think that's enough, and I'll move on to somebody else.
Can I just ask one question before we pass the floor to Professor Hammond? And that is that there were reports a few weeks ago about steps that in advance of the inaugural the president was doing with regard to employees within the agencies. And in particular, requesting information from these employees as to types of work, the possibility of pay cuts, and the like. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not an expert in civil service law, but there are certain limitations as to what the people can be asked about. And without looking at the questions and the statutes in question, I'm sure that the NTEU and other federal unions will be looking at that with some care. As far as the pay is concerned, I was told about a law which seemed to give the president wide discretion, but I have not looked at that carefully to see what's going to happen. But in a way, those cases are easy because there's no question that people have standing to object. And part of the question is who they sue. To the extent this was done by the transition team, it may raise different questions from it being done by people once they get in office. And then the question is who is doing it and for what purposes and what justifications they have it.
Thank you so much. Professor Hamm.
I'll say a few things specific to energy and the environment, and then I have one additional point as well. But I think consistent with what Dean Morrison said, most of the energy and environment issues that we're looking at in this administration in terms of legal issues really do boil down to administrative law. Of course, where we expect to see perhaps the quickest action is with respect to climate change. President Obama had all kinds of initiatives all across the federal government with respect to climate change, and President Trump has promised to do away with those. But how easy it is to do away with those depends on what it is specifically we're talking about. I keep checking my emails and websites to watch for him doing things. Doesn't seem to have done anything yet other than take down the former White House page on climate change. So we don't have that, and I should say we've lost some documents there. There were some working group reports, other materials that had not been officially published that now a number of scholars across the country are working very hard to try to get copies of. A good resource for that, by the way, both prior climate change regulatory efforts at the state and federal level and now a deregulatory tracker are on the Columbia Law School's website. So if anybody wants to take a look at that, that's where that is. More specifically, I think one of the biggest hot-button issues for the Obama administration, but also in terms of what the Trump administration will do, is dealing with greenhouse gas regulation under the Clean Air Act. A Supreme Court decision in 2008 held that the Clean Air Act's definition of air pollutant is capacious enough to include greenhouse gases, and EPA under Obama started regulating greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act. What's interesting about that is what EPA did. One of the first things it did following that 2008 decision was make a finding that greenhouse gas emissions endanger public health and welfare. This is a rulemaking. It is published. It is supported by an extremely substantial record, and it really forms the basis of most of the other regulatory actions under the Clean Air Act that the Obama EPA took. So the challenge here for the Trump administration, even headed up by somebody who does not believe in climate change, is to undo those rules when faced with a very strong record. Because a number of the regulations of greenhouse gas emissions were done pursuant to notice and comment rulemaking, they have to be undone in the same way. And there what will have to happen is EPA will have to explain why greenhouse gas emissions no longer endanger public health and welfare, notwithstanding the significant record that EPA amassed a few years ago. So that could be very difficult. Now, another shortcut would be to work with Congress. Congress could simply amend the Clean Air Act to provide that air pollutants do not include greenhouse gases, and that would be the end of it. Then EPA would not have had the authority to issue those regulations that are on the books right now. A couple of other things to keep an eye on, and these were carried out by executive order and other executive actions, so these are things that are going to be a lot easier for the Trump administration to change. One of them is quite recently an interagency task force developed an accounting metric called the social cost of carbon. When agencies, not just EPA, but any agency engages in benefit cost analysis for purposes of OMB compliance, they have to account for the social cost of carbon if the issue that they're considering raises that potential cost. That is something that presumably the Trump administration can direct agencies to stop doing. That is not statutorily required. And of course, decision-making at agencies does have to be reasonable. It has to explain what it's doing, but this is not something that was statutorily required. I'll say one other environmental issue. So the White House took down its action, its climate action website. It put up a brief statement of the energy plan. It's funny. It talks about energy, but it also talks about the clean water rule, which is kind of a different category. But with respect to energy, Trump has promised to bolster both fossil fuel production, natural gas and oil, as well as coal. That might be difficult because those fuels compete with each other, particularly in the electricity market. Okay, so maybe we make a market overseas and we export natural gas and coal, but I think we're going to hear more about how some of the trade restrictions might go both ways. So that's probably more of a achieving policy matter than a legal matter. But in terms of the law, we probably can't expect to see permitting go faster, where federal permitting is required for things like production of oil and gas, for building pipelines and approving those. And there we'll need to rely on FOIA to make sure that agencies have followed the procedures that they're required to by law. I mentioned the Clean Water Rule. This is a rule issued by EPA meant to clear up confusion about the jurisdictional reach of the Clean Water Act. It's currently in litigation, both at the Sixth Circuit on the merits and also before the Supreme Court on some jurisdictional issues. Trump has pledged to undo the Clean Water Rule. Again, it's a regulation, so doing that would require notice and comment rulemaking, but we also have this playing out at the courts at the same time, so it will be interesting to see what branches of the government move first on that one. One final thing I wanted to mention, this is an administrative law issue. On December 24th, 2016, President Obama signed into law the Defense Reauthorization Act. Buried in that act is creating a new agency within 180 days of the statute. It's called the Global Engagement Center. It is located within the Department of State, and its mission is to identify propaganda. All right. Its mandate is to collect information and issue anti-propaganda notices. All right. You can probably imagine what this was directed at, right? But you can also, it raises a lot of questions when we say, okay, now we're going to have an administration in place that has disputes about facts and how that's portrayed in the media. And so keeping an eye on this agency, how it's constituted, how it runs itself, I think is going to be an important legal issue and one that will be more difficult given that it's in the State Department, that it raises national security issues, and may be actually exempt from FOIA in some circumstances. So keep an eye on that one.
Thank you so much, Professor Hammond. If I could just follow up with one quick question. Let's assume that on the greenhouse gas there's an effort to undo the rules. How long would that take? I'm sorry, just to get a perspective, yeah. I would imagine he's going to probably steer this to the Congress, I would think. But just you know, out of curiosity, because we're hearing all these announcements of undoing this and that, and I'm just curious for
it would be stunningly fast if it could happen in a year. I think 2 years is more likely, and then, of course, there will be litigation following that. So we could certainly see things that are begun now in this administration and actually not resolved until the next administration.
Yeah, great.
The good news is everything can't be done first.
Professor Schooner.
So first, since we have such an interesting group here, I don't know about you, but I personally thought Saturday was one of the most remarkable experiences I've had, having lived in Washington, D.C. for more than 45 years. I also think it was the single day more than any other that I've actually enjoyed Facebook. I saw my relatives and my friends and my colleagues literally engaging around the world chanting, this is what democracy looks like. And I think we all need to keep that in the back of our minds. What I'd like to do for the next few moments is I'm going to drift from macro to micro and then come back to macro. So I'm going to talk about a little issue and then put it in the context of why it matters. So when you ask yourself, Why is that Professor G.W. wasting all that time talking about a single hotel in a hotel enterprise? I'd like to put it in context for you. Most importantly, this is the single most blatant conflict of interest that the President of the United States has, and it's also the easiest to fix. So whenever you get sucked into the complicated discussions, don't lose sight of those two things. Most blatant conflict, easiest to fix. This is a specific contract between Donald Trump and the United States government, specifically the General Services Administration. Turn to page one of the contract where you read that the tenant is Donald J. Trump, DJT, and DJT's wholly owned company. All right? So there is no complicated issue here. But it's also why at the January 11th press conference, when the president trotted out a tax attorney to wax eloquently on the Constitution, and they said they were going to turn over management but not ownership, they don't get it. Now, putting aside the fact that they haven't done what they promised to do repeatedly, so during the campaign since then, but as far as we know as of today, the things that were promised at the January 11 press conference haven't been done, the key point is don't lose sight of the fact that the president personally, the president's family, the president's business owned the hotel and the rest of the enterprise. Okay, let's take another step back. This is one of the best examples we've seen that the president has no intention of solving the problem. He's not going to mitigate or resolve the conflict. Just like you've seen the dissembling on taxes, the same thing. During the campaign, I'm going to deal with it, all right? Let's just go to the facts. GSA is on record at this point indicating that, you all wouldn't know this, but the lease was signed in 2013, and for anyone who forgot, Trump announced his candidacy more than a year before the election, okay? GSA is on record saying that even when he won the nomination, they haven't heard from the Trump organization about working out the conflict. Even after he won the election, they haven't heard from Trump, nor have they returned calls or inquiries. January 11th, after the press conference, GSA put out a press release, in effect saying, we have no idea what the Trump organization is thinking because they're not talking to us. We're trying to get more information. So let's be clear. They're not working on it. They're not planning to mitigate the issue. Now, how easy is this to fix? Contracts get transferred, or as we say, novated all the time. You may or may not know that the Marriott Corporation is headquartered in the D.C. metropolitan area. They run multiple Ritz-Carltons and the Mayflower Hotel in the city. They could run the hotel. They could take it over in a heartbeat, but they don't want to. All right, now, you may have heard that the lease specifically says, among other things, no elected official of the United States government may be admitted to or benefit or receive benefits that arise from the contract. I couldn't make it any more clear, okay? May not be admitted to, may not benefit from. Now, the interesting thing is there are, at this point, almost six people on the planet who have tried to parse the language saying, well, that only meant admitted to the contract at the time it was entered into. Your lawyers or law students, you know better. What's the point of contract interpretation? Sure, we start with the plain language. You can read the admit and focus on it, but you can't ignore the benefit therefrom. So facially, that's crap. But even if it wasn't, what's the point of contract interpretation? Let's try to figure out what the intent of the parties was at the time they entered into the contract. Is there anyone in this room that thinks that at the moment they signed the contract, GSA would have been okay with the understanding that at some point during performance, the president, the vice president, a senator, a representative, the D.C. mayor, or a D.C. council member would have joined the lease agreement? No. Okay? So just don't buy the... There's no dispute about this. You can parse language, you can play games, but there's no way, if this goes to litigation, that GSA is going to lose. Okay. Let's put the conflict in action. Let's make it real. This is a long lease. Okay? Hundreds of pages, lots of attachments. The three things that are interesting, though, is every year, The lease requires that the Trump Organization make a massive, and when I say massive in detail, I mean a massive financial disclosure about ownership, income, and expenses with regard to the hotel. Anybody getting queasy about transparency and financial disclosures of Trump family business information? Okay, so somebody at GSA has to enforce the financial disclosure, then they have to decide whether to audit it or not, and then they have to sit down and renegotiate the rent based on the consumer price index and the rent differential. Think it through. Some GSA career employee has to sit down with the president's children and negotiate a rent differential. But wait, it gets better. Who do they work for? They work for the administrator of GSA, who is appointed by the President of the United States and serves at the president's pleasure. I can't write a better conflict for my exam. I mean, this is, but again, let's make it language. What's the conflict? The GSA employee can't serve two masters. The GSA employee has to choose. Do I please my supervisor and the president's children and the president, or do I negotiate rigorously in the public's best interest? That's what a conflict is all about. But it's not just a hypo. What are the facts that we know? Foreign states today are clamoring to host events and be seen and spend money lavishly at Trump hotels. Now, I wish Spencer Overton was here with us, but as most of you know, if I want to make a $100,000 contribution to my representative or senator, that's going to be publicly reported. But how about if I call up the Trump hotel and say, I'd like to host an event. I'd like to negotiate with the president's children, please. I'd like to put about $100,000, maybe $150,000 into this event. I actually don't care if the event happens or not. I just want to give you the money, okay? But I'd like to actually hand it to one of the president's grown children, and we can have the event, and I don't care if it happens or not. But if it does happen, great, we'll take pictures, okay? That's not going to get reported anywhere, all right? Just think about that. I can go to the hotel and give money to the president's family business and the president's grown children, and I don't have to disclose that. Okay, it goes on from there. What I want you to think about in this context is every single policy issue that the president is involved in is implicated in the family business. Labor, what you pay workers, who you can fire, who you can discriminate against. Environmental issues, think where the Trump properties are. Tax issues, many of you know that Trump is currently in a multi-million dollar, maybe $100 million dispute with the D.C. government over taxes right now. But what about national security? Okay? Here's the one where I bring it back to macro. Come back with me to 9/11. I'm a terrorist. I choose three symbols to strike at the heart of America: the White House, the Pentagon, the Twin Towers. Is there anyone in the world that might like to strike at the President of the United States? I don't have to go to D.C. anymore. Anybody ever seen a Trump property in downtown New York, Chicago? I was in Panama City, Panama recently. There's a Trump Tower there. Just pick real quick. What's the city that's had the greatest terrorist influx in the last year? Of course, there is a Trump Tower in downtown Istanbul. Okay? Now, as the public, are we required to protect these properties? Are we responsible for the innocent people who are in a Trump building when it's damaged, if not entirely destroyed? Are we going to be drawn into conflicts and deal with the ramifications when Trump properties are seen as the targets of terrorism? But here's what I want you to focus on. This is not hypothetical anymore. This is a legitimate global national security risk. And what I want you to not lose sight of is, first, it's avoidable. The way you make this risk go away is the president divests his ownership interest and he takes his names off the targets, I mean the buildings. Okay? Not funny. Just remember, this stuff matters. But not only does it matter, the only reason we have these conflicts is because it benefits the president. There is no benefit at all, and in fact, there are massive risks to this nation because of the president's selfishness and his ownership of these properties. That's why we need to resolve these conflicts.
Thank you, Professor Schooner. On a specific issue, in terms of going forward on the lease, what legally can be done outside of the context of the two parties to the lease?
So this is actually complicated. You know, I do live in a world, government contracts, where the public generally doesn't get involved and probably lacks standing. But there are some things you can do, and there have been some pretty effective calling campaigns. Call your representative and your senators and make sure that they understand that when they appropriate funds for GSA next year, those funds should be contingent upon GSA ending that lease. Call the GSA administrator and tell him or her that you're anxious about the future of the nation. Call the GSA inspector general and ask them how it can be that they haven't resolved this issue yet. Call GAO and ask them whether they have fully thought through and spoken with their congressional representatives as to not only how the conflict should be mitigated, but what we're doing about the national security issues involved in all this. GSA has a public affairs website that has been inundated with information from the public over the last couple of months. That's probably the best place to start.
Thank you. Yes.
There's an organization in Washington called the Government Accountability Office, and it is a creature of the Congress, works for the Congress, and it has, under its rules, it provides that any ranking member of any committee of Congress can ask for an opinion from GAO, and I've been working with Professor Schooner and others to try to get some members of the Senate to ask for an opinion from the GAO as to the legality of continuing Trump on the lease, because as persuasive as Professor Schooner's argument is, the Trump administration has not yet bought it. But the administration and the Congress will have to deal with it differently if a favorable opinion comes out of GAO. So that's one of the things to be done. Part of this is covered by the complaint filed by Crewe, which we'll talk about at the end of the session here, but I won't share it goes first.
And now we'll hear from Professor Clark.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. In terms of, you know, U.S.-China relations, I think most of the interesting things are going to happen in the policy sphere, and there's not that much I can say that's specifically legal, but I'll try to do what I can, and you'll forgive me if I go into policy a little bit. Just by way of backdrop, though, one thing I think that's very important to keep in mind is, President Trump has said a number of things about China, you know, in various fora, and they're sort of all over the map, right? Sometimes very friendly, sometimes very unfriendly. And one important thing to realize, though, is that kind of the challenges he's going to face in China relations are not, these aren't just about, you know, us having a new and unpredictable president with unclear policy preferences. There are other things going on in U.S.-China relations, and basically that thing going on is that, the kind of premises on which U.S.-China relations have been based for the last four decades, you know, since they were forged in the period from 72, Nixon's visit, to 79, normalization, really are no longer true. So, for example, remember that the original rapprochement was based on having a shared adversary, the USSR. Okay, well, that's no longer around. When the U.S. and China reached the kind of, you know, ambiguous but mutually unsatisfactory agreement about how to deal with Taiwan, Taiwan was a tin pot dictatorship that nobody really liked very much. Its government wasn't, you know, Henry Kissinger didn't think that the government there would last another decade or so. Now it's a healthy democracy with citizens who have no interest in being ruled by a mainland government. Third, back in the 70s, China's military was weak. Its government was passive in international affairs. Nobody worried about what would happen if they said hello to the Dalai Lama. You know, now loads of people worry about that. China's much more powerful in the world. And fourth, China's economy, you know, was a developing economy, needed the West a lot more than the West needed it. The consensus at that time and basically up until quite recently among kind of the foreign policy and business elite in the United States was that, the U.S. should have a policy supportive of China, friendly to China. You know, the U.S. brought China into the WTO. It's been very supportive of it in trade relations, you know, and certainly it's brought China kind of into the international order. That's changed now. There's a much larger and more influential group of people, in the foreign policy and business elite. Not everybody, but certainly a much larger group who now see U.S.-China relations largely in competitive terms. So basically, President Trump faces a much tougher challenge on China policy than many previous presidents. On some of the specific kind of law-related issues, I'm going to sort of tee up the trade issue, and I think probably Professor Charnovitz may have a few things to say about the China trade issue. But, Trump, as we know, has declared that China is raping us in trade. One of his main advisors on China trade issues is a UC Irvine economist named Peter Navarro, who has authored a book and a documentary called Death by China. So you can sort of imagine his position on China trade. President Trump has declared the following trade agenda, that he's going to declare China to be a currency manipulator, impose a 45% tariff on all Chinese imports. And Steve, I hope you'll address kind of the legal issues there. Those are U.S. law issues. And, abandon the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which apparently he did this morning, officially, and other trade deals in general. So the issue is, maybe the thing that I can talk about is, if he does that, what are the prospects for a retaliation, for example, by China, and what does that have to do with Chinese law? Well, China has several, domestic legal tools available for conducting a trade war. Just like the U.S., it has anti-dumping and countervailing duty actions, and those can be used in very politicized ways, just as they are.
And the Administrative Procedure Act doesn't apply to them, does it?
The what?
The Administrative Procedure Act does not apply to them.
No, they could be used quite quickly. That would be a weapon against people, U.S. exporters to China, against U.S. companies already in China. China has an antitrust enforcement system, which is already at least perceived by many foreign investors in China as being used in a rather arbitrary way. That could increase. And finally, one thing of particular concern to, I think, individuals doing business in China is the prospect of, criminal actions against employees of companies who have annoyed in some way or offended the Chinese government, because there is a certain history of doing this. One thing, we talk about issues. One thing I'd like to point out is a non-issue, which is often raised, and I think it's important to dispose of it, which is many people talk about China's large holdings of U.S. Treasury bonds, and so could China kind of hurt the United States by engaging in a massive sell-off, of its Treasury bonds? Well, I think this is one of those cases where, if you owe the bank $100, that's your problem, and if you owe the bank $1 million, that's the bank's problem. China has, in 2015, it ran a worldwide trade surplus of almost $600 billion. So that means, China has a particular economic policy which requires it to run a trade surplus. You've got $600 billion, you have to put it somewhere. There's no national mattress under which you can kind of hide the money. You've got to put it somewhere, and there's really only one financial market in the world that is large enough and liquid enough to take $600 billion, and that is the U.S. financial market, and in particular, a U.S. Treasury. So it's really not an option for China to say, oh, we're going to suddenly sell off all our U.S. Treasury bonds, drive down interest rates. Interest rates were already extremely low on U.S. Treasuries anyways. Another interesting sort of a legal feature of U.S.-China relations is in transnational litigation, and as economic relations between the U.S. and China have grown in scope and intensity, we're seeing more litigation involving the kind of the meeting of the two legal systems. So in particular, when people sue in the United States about things that have happened in China, the defendants will typically make a motion of forum non-convenience, which is to say, this case should be transferred and heard in China because, the witnesses are in China, the evidence is in China, maybe Chinese law applies, and so it would be much fairer to do that. Of course, plaintiffs will resist those. Also, in terms of enforcing foreign judgments. You know, if there's a judgment by a Chinese court, somebody wants to get it enforced in the U.S. So both in foreign nonconvenience cases and in enforcement of foreign judgments cases, that requires the U.S. court basically to pass judgment on the Chinese legal system and to say, you know, are people able to get due process in the Chinese legal system, or in the case of foreign judgments, did they in fact get due process in the Chinese legal system? And my own observation so far has been that actually U.S. courts have been, to me, surprisingly receptive to those arguments. You know, if you read any of the major media, every time it talks about the Chinese legal system, it will say, you know, sort of party-dominated, courts aren't independent, judges do what the government tells them to do. This information does not seem to have seeped through to the federal judiciary anyway, because they much more routinely than not grant forum non-convenience motions. If the mood in the country changes, you know, and these things sort of come from the top, if we get into some kind of a trade war with China, I think we may see significant changes there. And finally, the last thing I want to mention is some regulatory interaction. Both the SEC and the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, the PCAOB, have been involved in efforts to inspect Chinese auditing firms that do the auditing work for Chinese companies that list their stock in the United States. And to do that, you know, you have to be approved by U.S. authorities. You know, not just any, you know, Tom, Dick, or Sally can set themselves up as an auditor and audit these Chinese companies. So they've been, the SEC and the PCAOB have been trying to kind of inspect their auditing procedures. And China has been very reluctant and unwilling to allow that, and in fact has said, you know, you cannot, to these auditing firms, you cannot send your working papers, you cannot allow U.S. authorities to see your working papers. Now, the, you know, really the only final weapon against that resistance for these agencies is to say, we're going to disqualify the auditing firms. If they disqualify the auditors, that means that Chinese companies or companies with operations in China really cannot list on U.S. capital markets. So far, the regulators have not been willing to kind of take this nuclear option. And they've been trying and trying and trying to continue to negotiate with the Chinese government, but so far haven't gone very far. And again, if the kind of mood in the executive branch changes significantly, then I think we could see some very significant developments in capital markets regulation, which is to say, if they disqualify these Chinese auditors, no one will be able to give a proper audit of China-based companies, and so they won't be able to list in the U.S. anymore.
Thank you, Professor Clark. On that last point in particular, if you look at another area, banking, and in the banking sector and the Federal Reserve looking at the activities of how China regulates banks and relying on that regulation as a way to get a gauge of whether a bank should be allowed to come into the United States, another possibility of pushback. Let me just raise just one quick question, if I may, and that is, ever since the election, have you noticed a sort of a reinvigorated China, a China wanting to come into certain countries in particular, taking a lead in Asia? Because if the United States is no longer going to be involved in the TPP in particular, perhaps this is the opportunity now for China to start building relations with other countries.
Yeah, actually, I had a little section in my prepared remarks to talk about that, but it's not strictly legal, so I decided to leave it. But it is policy, and, you know, we can talk about policy, too. So there's an interesting kind of maybe a contradiction, or maybe there's going to be a battle for the soul of the Trump administration, because on the one hand, there are some real China hawks in his administration. There's, again, Peter Navarro, who I mentioned. Michael Flynn, his national security advisor, has written that China is part of a global alliance with radical Islamists. So these are not people who have friendly attitudes towards China. At the same time, so China is, of course, trying at the moment, and has been for the past few years, you know, to expand its influence in, you know, the Western Pacific and in Southeast Asia. So at the same time, Donald Trump, both before and after the election, has been, you know, calling into question America's commitment to security alliances, in particular NATO, for example, which he called obsolete. He has just announced the end of the definitive death of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. So we have definitely a sort of a narrative of disengagement from East Asia going on here as well. And if you are an actual or potential U.S. ally in East Asia, I think you're going to look at these things and say, you know, you're not going to have a lot of confidence that the U.S. intends to stay in Asia. And that's good news for China's expansion, I guess.
Okay, great. Thanks. I hope everybody can hear through this microphone. Okay, great. Oh. Yeah, I think I heard the echo when he was speaking, then I turned off this mic, so I think it's okay now. Yeah, as long as we turn it off. It's turned off now. Great. Let's hear a perfect introduction to Professor Charnovitz and the focus on trade issues.
Okay, well, thank you. In his inaugural address, President Trump criticized the education system for leaving students deprived of knowledge. You know, he did say that, but it's interesting. I checked the transcript today. The all was deleted from the transcript. But in any event, I wanted to thank Susan for holding this today. I wish President Trump were here to hear this excellent panel. Also, in his inaugural address, he did not mention the Constitution. He mentioned law enforcement, but not law. So our topic is the Trump administration and the law. It's a little early after 3 days, I think, to say too much about it. Let me offer a couple of benchmarks for thinking about this issue. The Constitution says the president shall faithfully execute the law, and I'd like to unpack that into three different issues relevant to us all as students and faculty and as citizens. One is obeying the law. Second, implementing the law, and third, improving the law. It was Senator Grayson in 1789 who first said, I think, the president is not above the law. So the president needs to obey the Constitution and obey the law. Steve Schooner has been a champion on this issue in recent weeks regarding the Trump property. The Trump Hotel is the Trump International Hotel in Washington, so obviously it's attracting international people. One argument I've heard about this that I don't find particularly persuasive is that this is a violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. But I agree that it's an issue. The Emoluments Clause says that no person shall accept a present or emolument from a foreign state. No person holding any office shall, without the consent of Congress, accept a present or emolument from a foreign state. I think the solution to this, if President Trump keeps all the properties, and I think he really should try to divest, but divestment's not that easy to do, but if he keeps them, I think Congress will need to legislate and ought to legislate to set some boundaries of what's acceptable financial behavior and what isn't. With regard to implementing the law, this is a challenge for every administration. They all have false starts and mistakes, maybe the first several days. It was George Washington in his farewell address who hoped for future presidents that every department may be stamped with wisdom and virtue. So that's a high test. We'll see if we can meet it. What are the sort of things that we should look at in the coming weeks? Well, obviously from this panel, there'll be a lot of litigation against the administration to look at. But also I would say, look at the way the president exercises his powers and discretion. Is he using executive orders and proclamations as a way to do an end run around the Congress? Is he using regulatory freezes and hiring freezes, such as those announced today, to circumvent the law? In foreign relation law, we have something called a sole executive agreement that presidents use to, in effect, make treaties with other countries without submitting it to the Congress. This is what President Obama did with the Paris Agreement on climate change. And I thought it went too far and should not have been done that way. But it'll be interesting to watch the way this administration deals with sole executive agreements and deals with treaty withdrawals. Another issue on presidential authority I'll mention, because I think it's a good paper topic, is what President Obama did on December 16th under the Outer Continental Shelf Act, where he took some lands off that ruled they would no longer be available for leasing for oil or gas drilling. And then the White House proclaimed this could not be changed by the new administration, that what the president had did was unalterable. I think that's a good paper topic for those looking for it, to see if a president really does have that authority under that law. The question of, I was asked to address the tariffs, and President Trump has threatened throughout the campaign to levy tariffs on China and Mexico. My guess is that it's all empty talk.
Why?
If he does it, it would be illegal. I don't think he's going to do it.
Statutes, right?
Well, you can't just impose tariffs willy-nilly. To some extent, if you do it in a non-discriminatory way against all countries, you can do it. If you cite some authorities like Trading with the Enemy Act, you could perhaps do it with regard to China. It'd be kind of a hard case to make, though. But the proposal to say, you know, if you relocate your investment abroad and like carrier and then try to import the goods back, we're going to put a 35% tariff, clearly illegal to do that. And I don't think he's really going to do anything like that. Third, on improving the law. Now, this was an election about change. And speaking personally, I would like to see America be made great again. And I would like to drain the swamp. So let me just talk about making America great again. We really need to invest in public infrastructure and education, technology, a lot of things that have fallen off in recent decades. Let me give you one example from my field of international trade. In 2007, Panama began building a new canal. And like Steve Schooner, I didn't run across him, but I was down in Panama last month, too. And so there's a new canal that takes much bigger ships. But not a single port in the United States is equipped to handle this ship, and not a single port in the United States even has plans for handling the big ships. This is very a failure to think long-term by American ports and our transportation infrastructure system, and we've got to do something about that. Also, I would hope the new administration would be bold. Think long-term. Avoid short-term fixes. We'll see if they do that. I would like to see the United States get re-engaged in the world economy. I look at what's happened in the last 8 years under President Obama, where we thumbed our nose at the World Trade Organization. I don't know that that will change under President Trump, but I think there's a lot of room for improvement in our trade policy. President Trump said he's going to renegotiate NAFTA. President Obama, when he campaigned, promised to renegotiate NAFTA. But 8 years went by, and he didn't get around to doing it. TPP was mentioned, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It was dead long before today. If Hillary Clinton had gotten elected, there wouldn't have been a TPP. The problem was that it was negotiated by the Obama administration in a way that just didn't involve the public. It was too secret. It wasn't an agreement that the public could support. I happen to think we can do trade agreements that would work for the public and for the economy. But, you know, that takes perhaps a little bit of a different model. On drain the swamp, there's no agreement on who the swamp creatures are. But, you know, I look at the Congress with an 11% approval rating, yet almost all of them get reelected. No accountability there. Too much entrenched incumbency, too many districts that are one party or the other. Very hard to have third parties in the Congress. They can't get any toehold because of the seniority system and the way Congress is organized. So I would like to see some structural reform. President Trump in the campaign called for term limits for the Congress. Granted, it's a bit undemocratic, but I think I would support that. So in conclusion, I'm not as perhaps pessimistic as many of my colleagues about are about the administration, but they clearly have their challenges. They haven't gotten off to a great start, and but it's important for our economy, for the American people, and for the world that they start to get it right.
Thank you, Professor Charnovitz. If I could ask you one question, and I'll have the floor passed to Professor Schooner for a question. With regard to renegotiating NAFTA, what would be some of the, let's just take one key feature you think that needs to be renegotiated?
I'd like to see NAFTA stronger. My guess is that this administration would want to make it weaker. But I think we could, the NAFTA has a dysfunctional dispute settlement system because any party can block dispute settlement. I would like to see that improved so that Mexico can bring cases against the United States, which they've tried to do, but they were blocked by the Bush administration.
Okay. Professor Schooner, and then we have first question from Professor Salzberg, but we'll then open the floor for questions. Yeah.
So I would like to conceptually agree with one of the excellent points that Steve made with regard to infrastructure investment. Now, unfortunately, I think that these are empty words, and the Republican Congress has no intention of letting them make the investment necessary. So what we're hearing is a possible national conversation about public-private partnerships, and for those of you who've done work outside the United States, you know the term BOT and BOOT, build, own, transfer, build, own, operate, transfer. You may not know that the United States federal government is a full generation behind the rest of the world on public-private partnerships, BOTs and BOOTs, and we're even behind the 50 states on privatization. So we're like our own little island on not taking advantage of this. But the point that I really want to make to drive home with Steve's point is that if you really want to make the country work better and make us more efficient, what we know historically, economically, and practically is if we put money into roads, bridges, the electrical grid, pipelines, the internet and public Wi-Fi, high-speed rail, and by God, airports, we have the worst airports on the planet, then literally everyone would benefit. And there are terrific models from around the world, but in our own closed-minded insular arrogance, we have been hesitant to get on that bandwagon.
Yeah, and if I could just say, I think a lot of that is probably has to do with Congress, getting back to Steve's point. Yeah, Professor Salzberg.
So I don't know if everybody knows this, but Kellyanne Conway is our graduate, and I remember her very well. And I just want to say I did not teach her about alternative facts. It turns out GW may have done some damage there. GW may have set the stage for upending the Affordable Care Act, right? Our colleague Jonathan Turley wrote a lawsuit on behalf of the Republican leadership in the House challenging whether or not the spending, the subsidies in the Affordable Care Act were lawful because the House of Representatives, he said, didn't approve of it. I thought it was a long shot suit, but my God, he won. Federal district judge said the subsidies were illegal and the Obama administration appealed. Most people think that Kellyanne Conway's husband is going to be the Solicitor General. Most people think that the Trump administration will withdraw the appeal. In which case, without those subsidies, don't you think the Affordable Care Act is in huge trouble?
If it's not clear that they will be allowed to withdraw it, the court, the matter is before the court, and the court could refuse to do so because there's a judgment that has to be enforced, and there are serious standing questions in the case as to whether it's enforceable. But assume that it happens, of course, there'll be 12 million or so people immediately thrown out of their plans, and actually, it's going to be a bigger problem for the Republican Congress than it could be for the people who are withdrawn, because they're suddenly in a situation where you could actually blame somebody for losing all your subsidies. So the answer is it could radically change it. Whether they will step in or not, I mean, the current plan is to repeal and then postpone the effective date of the repeal. If they win this case on that grounds, the HHS would be forbidden from paying out the subsidies and therefore would be no opportunity for postponement at that grounds. Can I talk a little bit about this case?
Sure, yeah, and then we'll
have a question. So, look, there was a case filed by an organization called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, which is my client in another case, so I got to be careful about what I say, I guess. Anyway, they have filed a case challenging the on the emoluments clause, Trump's refusal to divest himself of all of his property, not limited to the hotel lease, although it's prominently displayed there. So there are two main questions. The first question is a standing question, whether an organization that's designed to ferret out unethical conduct in Washington has standing to get an injunction against the President of the United States. It's a very difficult standing question. It's a case called Havens Realty, which I won't bore you with, which is a statutory case involving race discrimination that arguably supports it but probably doesn't in many respects. So they got a big standing issue. And then there's the emoluments question. And I must say I have to agree with I've said this publicly before, so it's nothing new. The interpretation by the Trump administration and by the Obama administration that the emoluments clause does not apply when there is exchange for value, so that if a foreign dignitary comes to the Trump Hotel and pays the stated rate, that's okay as long as they don't pay more than. Now, of course, it's very difficult to deal with when you're dealing with conventions and things like that where there's no stated rate. But let me give you a hypothetical as to why this is a problem. They say any exchange of value at all that the president benefits. So before he was elected, Barack Obama wrote two very successful books about himself that gave him lots of royalties. If the Saudi prince bought one of those books and Obama got an additional royalty from it, would he be violating the emoluments clause? And the answer, in my view, is no. That doesn't mean what Trump is doing is proper, but that the emoluments clause is not the way to go as long as it's exchange for value and policing in that regard. Can I ask, Don, is there also a problem about enforcing our copyright and patent law in China? Have they been pretty good about it, and could they get worse about it in terms of protecting our American companies like Apple, for example?
Yeah.
There have traditionally been a lot of complaints about intellectual property infringement issues, but when you look at kind of surveys of the American business community in China, what are they complaining about these days? Intellectual property enforcement seems to be relatively low on the list. It's more things like, first of all, uneven, unpredictable, and arbitrary enforcement of law generally, sort of vagueness, ambiguity. There's some issues in, labor law. But IP doesn't seem to be that much of a big issue.
And could that be a lever for China to start not enforcing our intellectual property laws?
I don't think China has ever done it for the benefit of the U.S. You know, in other words, I think in most countries, the U.S. has the same history, China has this history. You start getting IP enforcement when there's a domestic lobby for it. And there is more of a domestic lobby in China now for IP enforcement because they're producing more, valuable intellectual property in copyright, and they're trying to get, their own brand names marketed and things like that. Maybe it could be sort of symbolic that they would decide to really allow people to infringe much more than they have been, but I don't see it as a major battleground.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question going back to the standing issue. So with respect to this group that's brought the lawsuit, is it not also an issue that this lawsuit is brought currently at this point in time? Because as I understand it, it'll become a problem when he's renegotiating the lease. And I'm just wondering right now if the issue at hand and the violation of the Constitution itself or the alleged violation of the Constitution itself warrants this lawsuit coming now versus later.
So that's essentially an issue of ripeness. And according to the complaint, and if you accept their notion of the emoluments clause, then there are violations every time a foreign person enters a Trump property any place here in the United States or any place around the world. Professor Schooner's point was that the conflict becomes much more significant at the time that these other events have to take place. But if you accept their view of the Emoluments Clause, that Trump cannot accept any profit whatsoever from any of this, or even any revenue from this, then I think there's not a ripeness problem.
Yeah, I just want to be unequivocally clear that you don't need the Emoluments Clause to be extremely concerned about the hotel, okay? The hotel is an unequivocal conflict. One thing that we didn't talk about is do not get sucked into the statement that the president can't have a conflict of interest. It is true that at least one statutory disclosure requirement doesn't apply to the president, but a conflict is a conflict. What we don't want is the president to put his own personal family and business interests ahead of the nation's. And I think that if you want to take the broadest approach on it, think about it in terms of national security. But again, going back to Alan's point, I personally find utterly disingenuous the argument that a value for value transaction makes it all go away. But again, I'm just thinking about purchasing access without disclosure, and directly doing things that please the president that could be and should be eliminated so that he can, in fact, govern above reproach. That's what I'm talking about. So I don't need the Emoluments Clause on the hotel. I think that there are many other important issues to talk about.
Brian Kay, and then Dean Robinson.
I have a question for Professor Chernovich, and that is involving the Section 338 of the Terrorist Act, 1930. And last month, two Covington and Berlin lawyers really discovered this act, long-forgotten provision that says that if the president has the power to determine that the country is discriminated against imports from the U.S., or rather exports from the U.S., they can impose a tariff up to 50%. And I know that doesn't make it WTO compliant. It doesn't make it legal as a matter of international law, but it seems like the president has the authority at domestic law at least to raise a tariff against China. So I was just wondering what you would say in response to that.
There are a lot of authorities. I can list a whole bunch that even weren't in that paper. But you've got to have the prerequisite for it. And there's no issue of discrimination here. I mean, you'd have to show discrimination. The complaint about Mexico is not that they're discriminating. It's that they're a good place that companies want to invest, and they're stealing our jobs. So I'm not sure that law would be usable for the types of issues that are there. If you had some country that was discriminating against us, we could bring a WTO claim against them. We could also use that unilateral authority in 1338, but that using that authority would itself be WTO illegal.
Thank you. Dee Robinson.
Thank you for a wonderful panel. I think Steve, that graduate, I did graduate, took too much MOOC course. What I'd like to probe with Steve is this issue of with respect to the Trump property and others, but that it is a property controlled by GSA or government employees, and how does the supervision over all of the federal employees, how do you address that on the ethics issue?
The short answer is there's no way to resolve any of the conflicts. And the problem is when you sit down and start making a list of them, it's mind-boggling. So my guess is almost no one in this room has heard of the OFCCP, but that'd be fun. Just Google the OFCCP later. The Department of Labor has an office that basically ensures that contractors comply with labor laws. Is there anyone in their wildest imagination that thinks that at a Trump property it's possible that there is some discrimination with regard to the hiring or retention of what we call public-facing personnel? Any chance that at the Trump Hotel only good-looking people get certain jobs? Is that possible? Well, as a general rule, that's prohibited, okay? That's not the way we run the labor systems, and federal government contractors have some of the most sophisticated, complicated labor compliance regimes you're going to find anywhere. Again, we can go through the list on each one. There are more than $5 million of liens against the hotel at this point. We have a tax dispute. There's going to be environmental issues. But the reality is that on every single issue, there's a conflict. Another one that we haven't talked about hasn't gotten much press coverage, but keep in mind that the post office pavilion is a GSA building, but with the National Park Service, the Trump Organization has a pending application for historic designation. It seems to me that the moment the president was elected, the Park Service should have said, oh, we can't touch this anymore. I can't give a designation to the president's family that is potentially worth $200 million in tax benefits on his personal property. I mean, but again, this is just the tip of the iceberg, but it's every single thing. And I don't recall if you were in the room when we talked about this earlier, but remember, every GSA employee that has to enforce any aspect of the contract is supervised by someone who was appointed by the president and serves at the president's pleasure. And it doesn't make any difference if Trump is managing the company or not. He owns the property, and his sons are basically managing it for his benefit. He is the majority shareholder in the private company. And remember, anytime you read out there that there's an analogy to a publicly traded company, stop. Take a corporations class. It's not a publicly traded company. So there's some incredibly sophisticated commentary out there that would be interesting if, but it's not. It's him and his family in the business. So don't take the bait.
It's interesting. We started the conversation with documents, and one of the questions, and just to think about not to get an answer, is the extent to which the document retention policies and things like that apply to the business now, you know, because it's not clear what hat he's wearing. Matt, you had your hand up, and then we have a question here.
A question to Professor Clark about China. So you also mentioned about Taiwan. So he's clearly, it's worth surprising to see Donald Trump call the president of Taiwan and publicly challenge the one-China policy. And if that's not surprising in the future of Donald Trump administration, I just think further, maybe the next bargaining chip for Donald Trump about China will be Hong Kong. Hong Kong, in particular, compared to Taiwan, is much more important than China and also U.S., both economically and politically. So between America and Taiwan, there is clearly a law, the Taiwan Relations Act. And so Donald Trump can do something according to that law. But I'm just wondering, is there any existing law, both in America, domestic law, or internationally, can Donald Trump do something about Hong Kong to make it a bargaining chip? And also, this year is very important for Hong Kong because there is running for the chief executive in Hong Kong. So I think it's more.
So what's the last thing you said?
The chief executive. So I think this year Hong Kong is more politically and economically sensitive to both China and the U.S. So what's your thoughts about it?
I don't think there's really much the U.S. Can do over about Hong Kong. The only, from the standpoint of the U.S., I guess, you know, in the kind of international law order, there's only one way in which Hong Kong is kind of different from China, and that is, for example, in trade, Hong Kong is a separate, you know, customs territory, and so it has separate membership in the WTO, and the U.S. could conceivably, in principle, have different trade relations with Hong Kong from the trade relationships it has with China. I can't think of any way, really, that the U.S., is going to sort of use Hong Kong as some kind of a bargaining chip with China. Donald Trump's announcement about, well, the two things you mentioned. One is I think you mentioned he called Tsai Ing-wen. Actually, she called him. I mean, it seems to have been arranged in advance, obviously. It wasn't just, she rang up and said, hello, it's Tsai Ing-wen, you know, the president, this is the president of Taiwan. But so he took the call, which was, again, a break from a tradition, and then he announced also that the U.S. wouldn't necessarily be bound by previous one China policy, and if China didn't give the U.S. what they wanted on trade and other issues, then the U.S. might change its policy with respect to Taiwan. This was, it may be that it's a good idea to rethink Taiwan policy, given the changes that have happened since the U.S. first developed its Taiwan policy. Whether this is a good way to do it, I am much less confident of. Some people, supporters of Taiwan, have seen this as a good thing. To me, I am not convinced that announcing to China that you're happy to have Taiwan as a bargaining chip, I don't see how this is good news for Taiwan.
Yes, thank you all so much for coming and talking to us today. I'm a second semester 3L, and it makes me really sad that I won't be able to take any more classes with you guys, because there's a huge gap to my knowledge. So I would really like to know for this next administration. I think a lot of people here might be interested in working with some groups. Maybe I don't think you need to be a lawyer to submit a FOIA request or a notice and comments. So if there's a way that we could get involved in that, can we come to Professor Morrison and maybe Professor Newman for public interest groups or watchdog groups along those lines? Great. And then I have a question for Professor Morrison about tweeting and the president. Is it a violation of whatever, like, government, or I guess anyone could answer this, but the rule that you were talking about getting rid of records. So President Trump deleted a tweet on Friday. Is that a violation of it?
Well, the act of tweeting is neither prohibited or permitted. It doesn't, it's not, the question is, on what equipment did he do this, and was he trying to convey official positions of the President of the United States? I have not looked at the statute with tweeting in mind, but to the extent that there are records, the statutes deal with records, and if it is recorded someplace and captured by the White House's system or some system, then it's okay. As Hillary Clinton will attest, there are certain records that are private records and there are certain records that are public records. And in most of these tweets, Donald Trump seems to be dealing with public issues. If he tweets about how nice his grandchildren looked at the reception the other day, that would probably be okay and not a government record. We had this with Richard Nixon when they took all his papers and his tapes. They had to sort out the invitations to Trisha's wedding from the things he was talking about in the Oval Office with his cabinet officers. So I would be willing to bet a large sum of money that they are not readily now keeping the tweets and set up a system for keeping the tweets. But I think that's probably a nice question. And I suggest that you contact a reporter and have a reporter ask the question whether the tweets are being preserved pursuant to the Federal Presidential Records Act.
Can I just ask a clarifying question? So is it... would it be accurate to say then that even if he tweets on a matter of public knowledge, if the tweet is stored only on Twitter's server, that for him to delete it from the Twitter server, it doesn't violate any record-keeping requirements?
I don't know how he can... you excuse my ignorance, but I don't know when you say it's on the Twitter server.
Yeah.
If Twitter controls it, how can he delete it?
Because Twitter allows users to delete their tweets. Just the same way if you have email on the Gmail server, you know, you log into Gmail, that email is not on your computer, it's on the Gmail server. If you want to delete something, it gets deleted on a distant computer.
But I think that if it's a presidential record, take the emails, for example, it's unlawful in the sense, not a criminal act, but it's not permitted under Federal Records Act for people who work in the White House or any other agency to, even if they can delete an email from that, they have to be, they're supposed to be, the system is set up so they're supposed to be automatically saved by the government.
Yeah, but that's a different issue. Then it's saved someplace. What I'm talking about is it's only on the Twitter server, which does not belong to the U.S. government.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Let me just say one thing for everybody out there that wants to do something, okay? So you can't do everything, and I think one of the biggest challenges for the media has been that there's so many things we can't stay focused. So my first piece of advice to you is pick one thing and get involved. So six things that come to mind quickly if you want to begin your engagement. And again, this is just the tip of the iceberg, just six that have come to my attention. If you're on Twitter, hashtag divest Donald, okay? It's a broad community of mostly people who are interested in ethics and good government who are focused on the issue of why the conflicts matter. But just hashtag divest Donald, one word, and you'll see all the different issues percolating up and groups you might be involved in. Number two, there is a new group that I believe is called Rise Above. And they were originally a Facebook group called Lawyers on the Left, but they have now more than 120,000 attorneys. And I was actually at their conference on Sunday, but they're basically trying to bring together activists to focus on solving problems. So if you want to Google Rise Above 2017 conference, you'll see a massive data dump of people and issues and things like that. Number three, I admit, not my favorite group, but a very important one right now, POGO, the Project on Government Oversight, POGO.org. They're basically, on the one hand, muckrakers and whistleblowers, but they're people who are all about transparency. Number four, you've already heard Dean Morrison talk at length about CRU, the people behind this. CRU's not messing around, and the worst thing that happens at CRU is you meet some really, really dedicated, highly intelligent, sophisticated people. Number five, the Sunlight Foundation. There's a global conversation going on today about open government, opengov dot whatever. But Sunlight Foundation is one of the organizations in the United States that, among other things, is making lists of various conflicts that need to be addressed. There are legal issues, there are practical issues, there's IT issues, but again, check them out, Sunlight Foundation. Number six, again, not always my favorite group, the ACLU is thinking about ways that they can get involved. As many of you know, ACLU is a national organization and a regional organization. It may be of interest to you. I want to be clear, though. Tip of the iceberg. But get involved, go to the websites, read, and then find the thing that you're interested in. But don't get sucked into the, oh, my gosh, there's so many things I can't do anything wrong, right? Do something.
It can be overwhelming, and I think that's the challenge we all face, is to focus on the area that we're interested in and then also have some expertise. Yes?
So I think he has the legal authority to tell the Attorney General, the State Department, and CIA and everybody else, stop. That's going to be a big political problem for him. And it's going to be a big political problem not only for the people in this room and people who are marching, but also the Congress. There are a lot of members of the Senate in particular who are very concerned about Russia, and rightly so. And so I think he would be ill-advised to try that. It would be rather like Richard Nixon trying to shut down the special prosecutor's office, and the same kind of thing would happen. I think the reason that the announcement was made before the inauguration was so that it couldn't be stopped politically as easily as it could be stopped afterwards.
Students, how many of you have read the ODNI report? ODNI, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, there's a public version of the report. Read the report, okay? Talk about the report.
How long is it?
Well, it's 20 pages with lots of white space and a lot of repetition. Over half of the public report only makes a single point that, again, is useful for you to know and the public to understand. Over half the report talks about the fact that RT used to be Russia Today, and state-sponsored media is propaganda, and all of this ties in together. But you'd be amazed by how many members of the public today think that RT is just another news source. FT is a really good news source, right? If FT is a good, how many of you know what FT is? The Financial Times, one of the most respected newspapers in the world. So if FT is a good resource, RT must be a good news source too. Look, if you don't get it, how can you possibly expect the public to understand it? These are complicated issues. I know IT professionals who are struggling with making sense out of the nuance of this, but at least get the facts, be informed. You're some of the most sophisticated, knowledgeable, critical analysts on the planet. If you don't engage, don't expect the public to.
Do we have any more questions? Yeah. Okay, we got two.
Rollback executive orders, and it was kind of vaguely mentioned kind of the verbal assault on federal employees. I know Paul Ryan is in favor of eliminating some of the civil service protection. Just as a practical matter, though, I mean, presidents have really, other than Reagan and the Air Traffic Controllers Union, presidents have not been very effective in going up against federal employees and, you know, the unions and all of that. As a practical matter, is he not really hamstringing himself carrying out these changes that he wants to make, because so much of it is just going to be done administratively, and he's attacking these people, he's calling them, you know, he's referring to them as the swamp, and he wants to, you know, free hiring, free paying, he wants to fire people. Like, what, how effective is he really going to be if he's alienating huge swaths of civil servants who live really all over the country? There's a lot of different congressional representatives that I imagine are starting to phone calls.
I imagine a number of people on this panel have comments in response to your question, but we've had hiring freezes before. We've had pay freezes before. Those are not things that have had major ramifications for the president. I do think that we should not underestimate the power that the president has over agency heads and the ability to direct policy in that way. I mean, certainly, I'm sure you all in your jobs have encountered a number of civil servants, people who are very, very concerned about what the next 4 years are going to look like for them. But in terms of moving the policy ship where the president would like it to go, there are so many tools that are legal, right? So much of it comes simply from the appointment and removal powers. So I think that is a big hurdle to trying to sort of effectuate change through that system. I don't know. Others might have more comments on some of your points.
So when Truman turned over the presidency to Eisenhower, he said something like this: poor Ike, he's going to issue orders and nothing is going to happen. He thinks he's back in the army and the bureaucracy doesn't respond. So I think, you know, yes, I agree with Emily that clearly they can stop the people at the top, get the changes made at the top, but in order to get these regulations changed, they've got to do a huge amount of work, and that cannot be done by the head of the agency. It has to be done by other people, and the bureaucracy is terrible when you want it to move, but it's wonderful when you want it not to move. And so that's a real fact that's going to save us from a lot of the laws of inertia are very strong.
We have time for one final question. Yes, ma'am. Okay. So this is related to some things that Dean Morrison said, but it's a question for anyone. You mentioned to someone else's question that they should hand it off to a reporter and ask the reporter to ask the question. But at this point, it's almost unclear who reporters are going to be able to ask questions to. The press secretary has proven problematic. You also said that Donald Trump will experience political ramifications, but it seems unclear that with the amount of highly partisan lies around the internet. We call them alternative facts now. We call them fake news. The phrases keep changing. There's a large segment of the population for whom Donald Trump cannot be effective politically, it seems.
So I guess it's a two-part thing. Like, first of all, access to actual information from the White House. Are there any legal ramifications there? And are there any legal ways to combat the spread of lies on the internet that are what most people go to politically?
Oh, the Freedom of Information Act does not apply to the president and his immediate advisors, so you can't get anything that way. Second, he has taken on the press, but that's a risky thing to do. I was rather surprised yesterday in the New York Times, the top left column, the headline said, Trump lies at the CIA. I mean, that's a really big thing at this point in an administration for the New York Times in a headline to say that the president lied, not once but twice. And so the more he antagonizes them, the more they're going to want to go after him. Now, he's trying to exclude them from having access to the White House. He's probably going to be able to do that. He's the landlord there and probably can keep him out. But there are lots of people who have lots of information in the government, and they're going to want to find sources to divulge it to. Some of these websites may be useful repositories for that. So I think there's going to be a problem, but you're right that there's at least now a good third to 40% of the American people who are simply immune to the kind of criticisms that have been made for this period of time. But that doesn't suggest to me that people ought to stop making criticisms or stop trying to find out what's going on, because at some point, particularly if the balance shifts from promises to non-completion of the promises, then the people who have been going along with what he said are going to start to get unhappy with it. And we have something in 2 years called an election, but not for him.
Alan just mentioned the phrase "rather surprised." I think we're going to have "rather surprised" as part of regular conversation and the likes. There are a number of topics we didn't touch on, and I would imagine over the course of this semester we're going to have some additional sessions. For example, immigration. The future of international law. Human rights, I think that's a ripe conversation. I think there was an important discussion about the role of states now. There's going to be tension between states and the federal government, increased tension in all the areas that are represented here at the table. So I hope that we, throughout the semester, stay engaged in these issues, but I'd like to thank the panel for being here. She wasn't here earlier when I thank Professors Scooter, Hannah, Clark, Morrison on his way out, and Fitz.